Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. French-Greek elections cast doubt on European economy. That was yesterday's headline in the Toronto Sun. The Washington Post's lead sentence in its lead story on the elections on Sunday said, quote, "The shrill anti-incumbent message that has emerged from a pair of European elections carries a threat to the U.S. economic recovery and a political warning for President Obama, whose re-election prospects could hinge on whether the economy can improve." Joining us to talk about coverage of the elections in France and Greece and what they mean for the U.S. is Eric Reguli. He is the Globe and Mail's European business correspondent based in Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Great to have you. And we are also joined by John Nichols, who is closely following the upcoming election in Wisconsin, which is getting national attention. According to the Gannett Wisconsin Media Investigative Team, Republicans are dominating the battle for Wisconsin airwaves this year, with about 78% of the dollars spent on TV ads. More than $18 million in political ads had been booked as of April 25th in the state's five largest television markets. And Mike McCabe, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, says, quote, "We are in uncharted territory. There is nothing to compare this to. Really, there is nothing." John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation and author of Uprising: How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Rose. And the only thing I'll add to your great introduction is that you've connected these things so well, because Wisconsin's referendum on June 5th, or election on June 5th, is really the first American vote on a European-style austerity agenda.
Right. And
so there's really a connection there.
Yes, and so I'm so glad that you and Eric are both on, because I also just can't wait to talk about the media coverage of this. It's been fascinating to watch, especially the Washington Post usage of the word shrill, which Dean Baker pointed out in his Beat the Press column. But before we do that, let's start off on a positive note like we always do on Friday, and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, John, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I absolutely say it had to be Joe Biden's appearance on the Sunday morning talk shows, mm-hmm. where he was asked about same-sex marriage, right?
Right.
It's pretty damn important sometimes to ask the question and to follow up. And now, I happen to believe quite strongly that Joe Biden knew exactly what he was doing, mm-hmm. and that there was some intent there. I don't think it was a gaffe. But I do think that here's a situation where we're reminded that it's very important for reporters to revisit what are sometimes thought to be settled issues. Mm-hmm. There are so many times where I, as a journalist, and I'm sure our other guests here, will have just by chance kind of gone back to somebody and asked again and found that they really have rethought, or they've come to a new place. And so I will cite that as kind of the most remarkable and very high-profile moments where we got something that was staggeringly newsworthy, and I think was part of a chain of events that has been somewhat transformational in American politics.
So you thought it was calculated?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think you'd have to be, you know, unbelievably naive not to. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I've covered Joe Biden since the 1980s. The whole notion that he's gaffe-prone is, you know, he's had gaffes about, you know, like saying something a little bit risque about the health care bill being passed. He doesn't have gaffes where he speaks at some length about his attitude toward same-sex marriage. Mm. So this wasn't a gaffe. But it was one of those situations where, and again, maybe it's not so much great journalism as just an example of one of the important things, again, I'll emphasize, going back to issues, revisiting them, pressing people to talk about them. Because sometimes people want to say something.
Right.
And that's, I think, what happened last Sunday.
Well, and then later in the show, I'd love to talk to you about how this is playing out, because there are so many analysis pieces looking at why President Obama has decided to also embrace this policy. What is the political strategy behind this? That's the million-dollar question. So we'll talk about that later in the show. Okay. All right. Thank you, John. And what about you, Eric? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I found a piece by James Hansen. It was 2 days ago. It was an op-ed piece in the New York Times. And James Hansen is actually one of my heroes. He's the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And he has been sounding the alarm bell about global warming for as long as I can remember. In this particular piece, Rose, he's going after the Alberta oil sands in the northern part of the province. And in particular, President Obama actually has encouraged the development of the oil sands, and James Hansen is saying this could be a disaster for the planet, because this is one of the single biggest stores of carbon, and if it's burned, he says, it'll raise the atmospheric levels of CO2 to such an extent that it would resemble the levels of the Pleistocene era of 2.5 million years ago, when the sea level was 50 feet higher than it is now. Mm. In Canada, there's sort of a love the oil sands, hate the oil sands approach. Canadians tend to love it as an example of development and job creation, and they tend to ignore the environmental consequences. So I'm just really glad that James Hansen, in one of the world's most prominent publications that is read by many, many Canadians, is sounding the alarm bell again on this project.
You know, I read this last night. It's a pretty damning piece. It's called Game Over for the Climate. And James Hansen was one of the many people who got arrested in front of the White House during the Keystone protests. He really doesn't hold back in this piece.
No, not at all. And you mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline. That's crucial. Now, the pipeline would actually take oil sands oil down to the Gulf Coast refineries. In effect, it would allow the oil sands to increase in size by more than 50%. And the pipeline, of course, so approval was suspended by the Obama government. But I think it's going to get approved eventually, because the United States wants this oil.
Mm.
And, the Americans consider it the Alberta oil sands, in effect, their oil.
And in this piece, he says, quote, President Obama speaks of a planet in peril, but he does not provide the leadership needed to change the world's course. The science is clear. It's time for the politics to follow. So it sounds like he's hoping that a debate or something will come of this piece, because we're really not getting anywhere on this issue in this country.
Well, there were big protests against the pipeline, but I just think this pipeline and the expansion of the oil sands will keep going, because the United States really wants to reduce its dependence on OPEC oil, and here you have oil in right next door.
Right.
What everyone forgets, though, is the environmental consequences. This is to make this oil, you actually have to burn natural gas to heat up the ground to make this oil liquid enough to pump. And it's burning a huge amount of energy to make energy, and it just doesn't work from an environmental point of view.
And just briefly, Eric, before we dive into the elections, how is the Obama energy plan being covered in Canada?
Well, Canadians who are in favor of the oil sands are very upset that the Keystone XL pipeline the review was suspended. So they don't like his environmental policy, and also the small but quite strong pro environment crowd in Canada thinks that Obama's a hypocrite, because he talks about environmental cause, at the same time he actually is encouraging the development of the oil sands in Alberta.
All right, so kudos to James Hansen for this New York Times op-ed, Game Over for the Climate, and we'll put a link right after the show. And so let's dive in here and talk about all of these elections happening overseas and also in the States. But first, Eric, why don't you just give us a quick overview of what happened last week in Greece? There were no clear winners, and now different factions are trying to cobble together some sort of coalition. What's going on? What's the latest?
Well, what happened on Sunday, there was a general election in Greece, also one in France, which, I mean, we can talk about the connection between the two. The two mainstream parties, the center-right and center-left, pretty much got obliterated, and the formerly fringe parties on the far-right and far-left gained a huge amount of popularity. Why did this happen? Most of these smaller parties, which collectively got about 70% of the vote, are against the austerity packages, which they blame, and I think they're right, for killing off the Greek economy. Since then, the three biggest parties, the center-right, the center-left, and the far-left, have been trying to form a coalition government. Each so far has failed. And there's one of two options right now. If a government's not formed by tomorrow, they will either go into a new election, a new general election in June, or try to cobble together a caretaker government to keep Greece going until probably September, in which case there would be a general election. Right now, we just don't know which way it's going to go. But it's a total political mess, total gridlock. I've never seen anything like it.
Never seen anything like it.
No, I mean, it's completely dysfunctional. Greece needs a government now. It's going off in absolutely every direction, to the point that the sponsors of the Greek bailout, the International Monetary Fund and the European Union, are threatening to withhold bailout funds. And if those funds are actually withheld, Greece will go bankrupt the next day. And then the next question is, does Greece leave the Eurozone? I think it probably will. I mean, it's not a foregone conclusion, but certainly the odds have increased that it's going to leave the Eurozone, get rid of the euro, and take its old clapped-out drachma back, which it couldn't devalue.
That's huge if they leave the euro. I mean, we've been talking with you about this for the last couple of months. John Nichols, what's your read of what's happening in Europe, specifically Greece and France? And what are your thoughts on the way that this is being covered in the U.S. media? Again, the Washington Post lead sentence, they're calling this a shrill anti-incumbent message.
Yeah, I'm sure that the British media in 1776 had similar language with regard to the American Revolution. What's happening in Europe is that the people in country after country, from different perspectives, and that's important to understand, these aren't all the same storylines, but in Italy in the local government elections, in Germany in their state elections, in Greece in their national elections, in France in their national elections, particularly in the first of their two-tier national election, have been reacting with an absolute singular voice, saying, we do not accept the lie of austerity. We do not accept the fantasy that that everybody's broke. We believe in accountability. We believe that there are incredibly wealthy countries and individuals and corporations that have profited massively over the last better part of 20 years, taken immense amounts of wealth into their own coffers, and now are telling us that we have to give up pensions, give up education, give up public services, give up our union protections in order to make sure that those very, very wealthy individuals, to some extent countries and also corporations, are able to continue to live high on the hog. That is the simple reality. Now, in American media, that is covered as an irrational response, as a response that, you know, can't possibly be explained as anything but shrill and crazy and dangerous. In reality, it is a fully rational response. The French, actually, in their election, replaced a rather, you know, dramatic and dynamic political figure in Sarkozy with a relatively dull guy, a relatively dull Mandarin. But Hollande said that if he was elected, he would temper the brutality of austerity. And so this is the simple reality of what's going on. Unfortunately, most of our American media, because it doesn't cover economics or politics, doesn't even have the language, doesn't even have the frame, if they wanted to cover it well, to begin to talk about these things. So it's been miserably ridiculous coverage, often delinked from even basic storylines.
Eric, what are your thoughts on that? And what is the main storyline in Europe? Specifically, have you been following the Greek media, for example?
Yeah, but I just want to follow up on what John said. And
sure.
I largely agree with him. I think that, you know, looking at the coverage on both sides of the Atlantic, when François Hollande, the new president of France, is a socialist. And when you say socialist in Canada, United States, I mean, it's just, you know, he may as well be dismissed as a raving Marxist. That's not the case. I mean, I don't know if actually François Hollande is any more socialist than Nicolas Sarkozy was. In fact, his platform is not that much different. He is not scrapping austerity. He's not saying this is austerity's got to go. All he's saying is should be austerity light. In other words, he just wants to balance the budget a year later than Nicolas Sarkozy wanted to. Big deal. He's not, you know, he's not going to shred the alliance with Berlin. All he's saying is, look, we have to have austerity balanced off with growth policies. To me, that's very, very, it's not socialist or communist. It's very sensible economics. Austerity is simply not working here. I mean, austerity alone, it's got to be balanced off. I mean, Greece is a different story. There's a real paradox there. The left and the right want the austerity programs to end right now, but at the same time, most of these parties want the euro to stay intact in Greece, and I don't know how you can pull that off, really. I mean, it seems to me, I don't know if it's actually a binary equation, but you have to have some austerity in the sense that, you know, you have to have economic reform as opposed to just cutback. Austerity just doesn't mean spending cuts. It also means, you know, economic reform, labor mobility, allowing younger kids to get jobs, that sort of thing. Mm. So it's going to be very hard to kill off austerity and for Greece to stay in the euro.
That is Eric Regulli. He is the Globe and Mail's European business correspondent based in Rome. And we're also joined by John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. And if you have any specific questions about media coverage of the elections in Greece and France and what's happening with the European economy, now would be a good time to call. Eric will be with us for about the next 8 minutes or so. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you've read stories about the elections in the U.S., what do you think of the angles reporters are taking on this, and specifically on austerity? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Eric, we have a question from Armand. He says, what percentage of Europe's financial crisis is due to their purchase of our bad mortgages? Do you know?
Oh God, no, I don't. I mean, there's no doubt that the mortgage crisis in the United States rippled over into Europe and triggered a banking crisis. I mean, some of the biggest banks in the world are in Europe, such as UBS in Switzerland, and several of them collapsed. UBS didn't, but several of them did collapse. But this is a different sort of crisis. I mean, this would have happened anyway, even absent the U.S. Mortgage crisis.
All right, well, let's go to our caller, Jeff, calling from the East Bay. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Let me say what an honor and privilege, however remotely it is, to be on the air with John Nichols. He's one of my heroes. I wanted to call attention to the May 24th issue of Rolling Stone, Matt Taibbi's article on how Wall Street killed financial reform. One of the things it points out is in piecemealing apart Dodd-Frank, the banks will be able to offshore a lot of their derivatives trading. And it seems to me that a lot of countrywide issues came from the UK. And I would wonder if anyone in the European Union is looking at this to see if we're going to offshore these practices to them.
Well, thank you. We'll find that article. Are you familiar with this, Eric?
No, not really. At the risk of being, I don't want to sound stupid. So, John, do you have a? Can you answer that question?
Well, Eric, you're never going to sound stupid.
Yeah.
You're one of my favorite reporters in the world. And you know, the smartest reporter always is the one who says, does somebody else have an answer?
Yeah, exactly.
To some extent, yeah, I'm familiar with Matt's article, and I just flat out tell you, anybody who hasn't read it should race to it. It is so unbelievably well written. And it goes to the heart of some serious matters. These policies have already been offshored. I've been working a lot in recent months with accountants, specialists on accounting, and one of the things that they will tell you is that one of the most troubling exports of the United States is accounting practices and ways that you basically hide money, move money around. And so many of these practices have been already offshore to Europe. And the other quick final thing I would add is as regards this question of whether U.S. mortgage debt is essential and U.S. mortgage problems are, they really do underpin an awfully lot of the European crisis because the instruments that were developed, basically the junk that was developed, was sold quite frequently, particularly to some key Icelandic, Scottish, British banks, as well as some European ones. So there's an interlink here. Eric's exactly right about the fact that there are broader economic problems and there are broader economic issues, but you can trace so much of the trouble in Europe back to things that did happen in the United States.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Jeff. We'll definitely find that article and link to it because it's incredible to think about how things are so closely connected now. And we have another question about Europe. Let's hear from Gloria in Berkeley. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say I love good journalists. You're so important to us. I wanted to ask if you'd seen any pieces in which the Greeks admit some culpability for their present plight.
Ah, Eric, any pieces where the Greeks admit culpability?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I know I live in Rome, but I go to Athens very often. It's been my second home for the last couple of years. And there are a lot of Greeks who blame themselves. I mean, tax evasion is absolutely rampant in Greece. It's a national sport not to pay your taxes. There's a lot of corruption. There are many industries like construction, trucking, all the usual suspects. They're absolutely rigged. And yes, a lot of Greeks do blame themselves for this. At the same time, many Greeks think that that these austerity programs are excessive punishment. That it's just too much, and that you know the Greeks are admitting mistakes, and to come in with these austerity programs and just kill off the economy is way way too much punishment. I would agree with that. I don't think the sin is so extreme that it warrants the sort of punishment.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Gloria. And we have time for one more call before we go to break. Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Hey, you're people on the line. Hi, John. How you doing, by the way?
Good to hear your voice.
And you're missing the role of Goldman Sachs in Greek even getting in to the Maastricht Treaty and becoming part of the euro currency zone. The, Goldman Sachs did a bunch of derivative deals with the government, and this was documented by the New York Times in 2010 and by Der Spiegel, that they never made the 3% deficit, annual deficit, nor did they make the 60% total debt requirements. There was a derivatives contract called the AOIS. I think another name was TITMUS, and there were some others that took, like, airline fees off the books and or push them out till years later.
You know, Andy, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have to go to break soon. And Eric, it sounds like we really need to do a show about this because we're getting a lot of calls about the connections between the banks in the U.S. and what's happening specifically in Greece.
I've reported on this. The caller's absolutely right about this. Goldman Sachs involved in this derivatives deal. Merrill Lynch as well. They claim it was legal, and the effect was it gave the illusion that Greece had less debt than it really had, thus allowing it to get into the eurozone. It's a really important story.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have you back to talk about this more in depth. Thank you again for joining us, Eric. Eric Regley is the Globe and Mail's European business correspondent, and we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with John Nichols after this. And I'm taking a quick break out of your call to ask you to support independent local public radio and your call. 100% of our show is funded by you. We would not be here without you. And today we are offering a copy of John Nichols' book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. For a $100 contribution, we will send you John Nichols' book, in which he shows how the Wisconsin case is a blueprint for progressives around the country who have had enough. He also explores how protesters organized and inspired the Occupy Wall Street movement. KALW.org. At the $100 level, we will send you John Nichols' new book at KALW.org. And I know that so many of you really look forward to our Friday shows. I get emails all the time saying, when is the Friday show going to be up? I always look forward to it. Because we bring on voices like John Nichols, like Eric Reguli, and so many other journalists who are out there doing really good investigative reporting, support that kind of radio where we have an hour to really talk to these reporters, go in depth to talk about their work, and find out what we're not possibly getting in the national media. $100 will keep this station alive and this show alive. KALW.org. And we will send you John Nichols' book. At the $50 level, our basic membership rate, we can give you as a thank you gift a DVD of the Tavis Smiley and Cornel West event a couple of weeks ago at the Paramount in Oakland. At whatever amount, you are keeping independent public radio alive. KALW.org. We never sell or share your personal information. We have the independence, really, to spend an hour talking about all of these very important issues, really making the connections between the European elections and the elections in the U.S. and austerity, and how that really is affecting everyday people. KALW.org. 100% of your call is funded by you. We could not do this without you. If you can afford $100, we will send you John Nichols' new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. And he really does give the people a voice in this book, and that's what we do on our show on a regular basis. KALW.org. The phone number will be available on Monday. KALW.org. $100 and we'll send you John Nichols' new book, Uprising. Support local independent public radio. Keep these voices alive. People like John Nichols and Eric Reguli and all the other incredible journalists that we bring on Fridays to really go beyond the headlines and bring you information you might not be hearing in other places. KALW.org. Thanks for supporting independent radio. And this is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we'll have a conversation with the filmmakers behind the documentary Semper Fi. It's about water contamination at Camp Lejeune, a military base in North Carolina. There was a major cover-up, and we'll be talking with the filmmaker. We'll also be talking about a member of the military who really dedicated his life to figuring out what happened at this base. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we are joined by John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation and author of Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. It's been great, actually, to see so many of you commenting there and actually having a dialogue. And I'd love it if you can comment there because everybody else can see it. But if you'd like to email, that's also available, feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, John, let's switch gears a bit, although it is very connected. And next month, Wisconsin will be holding their recall election. And it's been incredible to see this getting national attention, really, for obvious reasons, but also just to look at how much money is being spent. And we wanted to give kudos to the Gannett Wisconsin Media Investigative Team because they have a great piece about how Wisconsin is entering into uncharted territory in ad buying for elections. We're talking $18 million so far.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And you are so right to give them credit. In fact, I have to say, you know, I'm probably as critical of media as any media person you'll find. I've written books about it and spoken out a lot on the failures of media. But on the ground in Wisconsin, I have seen, you know, small newspapers and local radio stations, and I want to emphasize community radio stations, much like KALW, going out and doing just absolutely incredible work. And this report required journalists to, because we have a completely corrupt and dysfunctional system for reporting how money is spent in campaigns, it required journalists to go out to every television station of any consequence in Wisconsin. They had to physically drive to them all over the state, go in and look at the filings, look at what had been purchased to do this story. It's old-fashioned legwork journalism. Here's what's really fascinating. You use the 18 million figure. That's a big deal. But here's the most fascinating part. 78% of the money had come from Scott Walker and his Republican allies. So you have this incredible disproportionality. We don't only learn that there's immense amounts of money. We learned that in this Citizens United era, the money is overwhelmingly on one side, overwhelmingly corporate. More than 50% of the ads that were up were either bought by Walker, the Republican Party, or corporate interests that were specifically aligned with his candidacy or attacking his opponents. And, Rose, I'm going to ask you, you're as cynical a person as I've ever met.
Yes, a cynical optimist.
I'm teasing you.
But you're right.
Pessimist. A utopian pessimist. But I'm going to ask you, take a guess. So 50% from Walker and his house, what percentage was put up by unions and other groups, you know, any groups that have any tie to the people criticizing Walker? What percent?
Out of 50.
No. Oh. 50% of all this 18 million. So about 9 million
people
from Walker and his buddies.
Okay,
what percent was challenging Walker?
What, maybe 20%?
2.4%.
Wow.
This is a very important lesson for citizens as we look at the times we are in. Unions are strong. Grassroots groups are strong. They have meaning. But they cannot begin to rival the power of billionaire money and corporate money in a Wild West circumstance as regards television media, television ad buys. That's important for people to understand because so much of our media fosters the lie that there is proportionality, that somehow, you know, yeah, corporations are going to go spend money, but unions will too.
Right.
It's just not real. That you can't keep up with it. And that's a fundamental reality that came out from this very good legwork reporting by the Gannett newspapers.
Well, but you bring up such a good point here because we do, and we do this, when we write our intros, we say that Citizens United has given corporations and unions the right to spend wild amounts of money. And in every report we've been reading just in the last couple of weeks about money and politics, the union is also in the lead with the corporation. So are you saying...
It's not true, though. They can't be.
Hmm.
You know, and it's not that I'm not trying to be some sort of hack for the unions here.
Right.
Unions are going to spend money in Wisconsin. They spend money in politics. They're going to spend money to help Barack Obama. But do you realize that if all of the union treasuries in America were emptied out, if you emptied them all out and spent them on the Wisconsin campaign, that there are actually several billionaires in America who could rival the money with a check written out of their own account. So you took all the union money combined. It would not be sufficient, for instance, to rival what the Koch brothers could write out of their own account.
Hmm.
Well, so that's just the way to understand.
And what about the breakdown and the responsibility of the media to really break down this money and like you said, do the old-fashioned legwork and let citizens know where this money is coming from?
They just don't do it. I mean, you know, this is the incredible, this is the kind of sort of unsettling thing. The Gannett report was fantastic, and it was really good, and they gave you databases to work with, but they didn't do the figure I just told you.
Right.
I went into their databases and then did the next level of analysis. It's not because they're bad players. They did tremendous work and laid the groundwork, and they gave people like me something more to work with. But it takes time. I was sitting here with my little calculator adding up what each group did, then, you know, going online, checking out where the group's money was, you know, all this stuff. It takes time. And unfortunately, so many of the people who cover politics in America, there's two things that are really dangerous. Number one, they don't have enough time to do it. We have cut our news staffs. We have cut down, you know, just the basic legwork journalism. There's a lot less of it. We have a lot of commentary, very little actual physical journalism.
Right.
That's number one. So you got to accept that the people doing it are overwhelmed. But number two, they know that the safest say that everybody's bad, right? To say, oh, it's all equal. Corporations are bad. Unions are bad. Democrats are bad. Republicans are bad. Liberals are bad. Conservatives are bad. You know, just to kind of do a blanket condemnation without digging in. And again, it's not to say that, there's any angels here, but it is to say there's proportionality. And when we start to realize that, then we start to realize that our headline that says corporations, unions, flooding campaign with money is not a very accurate headline. And we also, when we do that, we dismiss one of the things that unions actually do bring to the political process. Corporations, CEOs, billionaires, they write checks. That's what they do. Unions cannot rival those checks. But if we begin to develop people's movements and more traditional unions that go back to what they're good at, which is organizing people, getting people knocking on doors, it is the people power, the physical power of citizens that may be the rival to corporate money, CEO money in a Citizens United era. That's a story we should be telling, but that requires you to look a lot deeper than just the campaign finance reports.
Right. And so this election is expected to cost about $6 billion. And, this is all connected also to Senator...
This election, let's be clear for our listeners that we're talking, that's the president.
Right. I'm talking 2012 altogether. No, of course. Right. The entire election. This is also connected to the defeat of Senator Lugar in Indiana. A lot of money was spent there. What does this really say about campaigns and really... money, the influence of money. I mean, if you don't have it, you're going to lose.
Well, yes. If you don't have it, you're probably going to lose, right? Here's what it should say. First off, from a journalistic standpoint, our journalism has to become very, very different. We have to throw away the playbook of how we covered campaigns 20 years ago and start covering them new. One of the real disconnects comes in broadcast media. Broadcast media still tends to cover campaigns, you know, with like sound bites and little clips of a candidate shaking hands, and it's ridiculous. It's not the reality of what's going on. The reality of campaigns is they no longer play out on the ground in the states where they occur. They play out in offices in Washington, D.C., where someone like Karl Rove decides whether to put $5 million into a state. And we have to get much better at covering that behind-the-scenes maneuvering of the money. That's number one. Number two, the current coverage of campaigns, by and large, is very disempowering to citizens and to citizen movements. One of the things that we're finding that is absolutely mind-blowing is that you can beat the big money. And here's an interesting example. In your own state of California, in the gubernatorial race of 2010, Meg Whitman dramatically outspent Jerry Brown.
Right.
And yet Jerry Brown had the nurses, the California nurses, and other unions that went to the mat doing physical work on his behalf, something Meg Whitman just didn't have. And there's some evidence that a combination of a baseline of money for a candidate, be a good candidate or bad, with a highly motivated cadre of citizens who are willing out to go out and knock on doors, talk to their neighbors, really do it. And these are impassioned people in big numbers, can offset big money. That's why the Wisconsin story is such a great story, because we know that Scott Walker, who's already raised $25 million, that is more than has ever been spent on a gubernatorial race by all candidates in Wisconsin. He's raised it just unto himself. Scott Walker's got $25 million. His allies have already spent $10 million. That's taken you up to $35 million. It'll likely be doubled by June 5th, so you're talking about Scott Walker and his allies spending $70 million. The unions, the Democrats, are not going to be able to rival that. The question is, will this mass movement, which occupied the state capitol, the stuff I write about in the book, will the movement that occupied the capitol that was in the streets of communities across the state that has more than 30,000 people trained to go to doors, can that offset $70 million in corporate money and in CEO money? If it can, we may have a really hopeful story, a template for an alternative politics that can push back against money. We should be telling that story and looking at it, because that's what journalism is supposed to do. It's supposed to give you news. It's supposed to tell you about something new and fresh that's developing, not just cover stories the way they always were covered in the past.
And the people really did force this recall.
Yeah, the Democrats Democratic Party did not. The Democratic Party was scared of this recall. Obama was scared of this recall because it's like kryptonite. You're not really sure what it's going to do. Even the unions had a relative level of fear. The recall in Wisconsin, again, I write about this in the book because it's such fun stuff. The recall in Wisconsin was really driven by like little old ladies and college students and all the people we sort of push to the side of our politics so often, who said after all the big players went away, they said, we're still mad. We're still angry that this governor attacked our union rights, our schools, our public services, imposed an austerity agenda on Wisconsin. We want to do something about it. And so they went out in November, December, and January, in the midwinter in Wisconsin, over Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, with petitions. There were people who went on snowmobiles across country fields. There are people who walked out on frozen lakes and went up to ice fishermen to get these petitions. And they were told they had to get the insurmountable number of 540,000 signatures. They got 1 million signatures.
It's incredible.
This is a people's movement, and there's no other way to tell the story except to say that.
That is John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation and author of the book that tells these stories, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. And we have about 10 minutes left with John. So if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. There are so many elements to this story. What's happening in Wisconsin and really what's happening across the country. So what are your thoughts on coverage of these elections, coverage of the people's movement and the power that people really have when you look at Wisconsin and this recall? It's happening because people walked on frozen lakes and knocked on doors.
Yeah.
866-798-8255. And John really focuses on so many different issues. So if you have any thoughts about coverage of the Obama's announcement on gay marriage this week, or the defeat of Senator Lugar, the budget cuts, there's so much going on. We'd love to hear from you. If you have kudos, if there was a story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also post it, yourcallradio.org. And John, you brought up the unions, and CNN actually had an interesting article talking about Wisconsin, and kind of down in the article, it mentioned the fact that the majority of Americans, according to the polls, want unions. They want to protect their bargaining rights. Showed that the majority of Americans oppose stripping collective bargaining rights for public workers. But this wasn't really a key part of the piece. It was just sort of mentioned in passing.
Oh, it's look. The amazing thing is that even after a year and a half, remember, Wisconsin's been in the streets, literally in the streets. I was at a rally two nights ago, thousands of people in the streets. So we've had a year and a half of mass mobilization, physical mass mobilization, almost unprecedented in American history. And that mass mobilization is not just Wisconsin. In Ohio, they had tens of thousands of people in the streets before they petitioned and successfully overturned their anti-labor law. In Michigan, they have had tens of thousands of people in the streets. In Arizona, they're still out, still battling the anti-immigrant, anti-labor initiatives in that state. Across this country, there are people's movements that are doing amazing things, and yet it's little covered.
Right.
We tend to cover only like one big rally and then walk away. Media tends to do that. And the interesting thing, though, is because of the sustained effort in Wisconsin, there was actually some polling on union rights. Now, the initial line from so many of the powerful political players on the right was that this is just a handful of union people, kind of a last gasp of the dinosaurs. They've crawled out of their caves, you know, one more time to raise the blue fist of solidarity before they collapse and die. Well, the polling, which was supposed to confirm that fantasy, said the opposite, said that especially in this austerity moment, we've been in an austerity moment for quite a while in America, not as bad as Europe, but certainly similar. In this austerity moment, people are starting to wake up in a big way to the fact that they need an alternative grouping, some way to organize as an alternative to corporate power. Unions are actually more popular today than they were in the past, and the numbers confirm that. Unfortunately, even as you walk in with absolutely confirmed polling data, you will continue to hear not just conservative commentators, but liberal commentators go on and say, well, you know, unions were very, very good in the 1930s, but, you know, this is a new era, a different time. Well, the people don't agree. Mm-hmm. Just as they don't agree with austerity in Europe, they don't agree with union busting in America.
Well, we've got a couple of callers on this, so let's hear from Ian in San Francisco. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I had just a couple of quick thoughts. Of course, the Internet's an inexpensive way to get the message out on these different ads that the other side are going to use in Wisconsin. But it seems like maybe screenshots of the ad, because they'll probably put out 10 or 12 ads over the next month or so.
Can I interrupt you, my friend?
Yeah.
I wish it was only 10 or 12.
Okay, whatever it is, screenshots of each of the ads with the list of what the lies are in that ad. And then when they come in with all this money from, like, you know, where they don't tell you who's paying for it. So, like, you got Karl Rove with this American Crossroads. Just say, this is an ad that is only from one man, Karl Rove, and show his picture. There's nobody else behind this but this one man. And if they say, no, we've got a lot of, no, well, then who are they?
Yeah.
Who are
they?
This is one man who's doing this.
That's good.
Yeah, okay.
Stealing your idea, okay?
We actually read there were 17,000 ads running.
Yeah, I mean, the ads in Wisconsin, but that was the only reason I interrupted the caller there, was to say, you know, you say it a dozen ads. It's like there's a dozen ads a day,
wow.
Different ads. I mean, they're just coming up. Right? Just when you turn on the television, you can't believe how intense it is. I mean, we are literally in a small state. In Wisconsin's like a 1/6 the size or population of California, a very rural state, really, in so many ways, and yet we are being inundated. Scott Walker hasn't just spent millions on TV ads. He's spent already more than $5 million on direct mail. So your mailbox, you come out and your mailbox is just packed with mail. Scott Walker may save the embattled U.S. Postal Service. And so the simple reality is that it's so intense. I like our caller's idea, and I want to use it to pivot into, it's actually a chapter in the book I write about the next media system. My argument, and it's an argument I think, certainly I wish I was smart enough to come up with it, I think a lot of people are starting to recognize it, that one of the ways that we counter corporate power and that we counter corporate media in this era is to fully utilize the new technologies that have become available to us, Facebook, Twitter, obviously all the digital platforms, YouTube. These are incredibly powerful tools. If we connect them to a little bit of old-school journalism, like what you do, Rose, so very well on this show and also in your other writing, like we see from some other media outlets, you know, if we connect all of these new technology to the good journalism that is coming out, we have the platforms available to us to kind of push beyond the lies and the fantasies of major corporate media. We're in a period of opening up of media, not closing down. Corporate media is doing a worse job than ever, but people-based, people-driven media is doing a better job than ever. And one of the things that we who cover media need to do is to get out of the silly old arguments between old media and new media, get into an argument or into a discussion about next media that combines the best of both.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We have just a couple minutes left. Let's try to fit in John in Santa Cruz. Hi, John.
Hello, Rose. Love your program. I'm on my local affiliates, KUSP.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add a comment. A contradiction that exists in Spain. I was in Spain, and even though the federal government there, the centralized government, is socialist, on the local municipal level, it seems to be going back to the right, and it seems to be going to, very conservative on the local level. That's quite interesting, because it's sort of a contradiction, because they are tightening the budgets up on the local levels. And I'd like to know John's perspective on that.
Yeah. I mean, the answer to this question is a really simple one, but it's such a good question and such an important place to go. My old friend Tony Benn, a longest-serving British parliamentarian, serving from the end of World War II into the early 2000s, always had a great line. He said that, you know, in a moment of extreme economic instability, when people really don't know where to go, because economics is so often told to us, taught to us as a dark science, which is hard to explain, hard to understand, people will go to the left or they will go to the right. And in many ways, it is who does the best job of explaining or trying to explain what's going on. You saw this play out in Greece. where you had Syriza, the great party of the left, really almost a, if Occupy was a political party, it would be Syriza, got three times the vote it got in the last election, actually has become the main opposition force in the Greek parliament. But you also saw the rise of neo-Nazis on the right moving up very quickly, similarly in the Italian elections. And I think we see it even in America. Mm-hmm. There are elements of the rise of the Tea Party on the right, as well as these mass movements on the left.
And we saw that in Indiana. And sorry to cut you off, John, we're out of time, but we'd love to have you back the week of the elections in Wisconsin.
I can't think of anybody I'd rather be on.
Well, we can't think of anybody we'd rather have. So thank you so much, John.
Take care.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. That's John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation and author of Uprising. It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. And I am here asking you to support KALW and Your Call, taking just a couple minutes asking for your support. John Nichols does excellent reporting. We love having him on. He can talk about almost any issue. And his book, Uprising, is yours for a $100 contribution. And in this book, he really shows how the Wisconsin case is a blueprint for progressives around the country who say they've had enough. And he talks about the people power, the stories that we try to bring you on Your Call to talk about what's going on beyond the headlines. People, I love this story about people walking on lakes to knock on doors. In freezing weather. John writes about that. He also writes about what he calls the next media system. What is the next media system beyond corporate media? Well, we're already doing that. People-driven media driven by you. We cannot be here without you. 100% of our show is funded directly by you. A $100 contribution to KALW. We will send you John's new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. At the $50 level, our basic membership rate, we can send you a DVD of Tavis Smiley and Cornel West speaking at the Paramount in Oakland. At any level, we welcome your support. If $25 is a significant commitment, then thank you. It's a collective effort, and we wouldn't have it any other way. That's how we stay on the air, and that's how we're able to bring on people like John Nichols and so many of the other journalists that you hear on Friday. If you appreciate that kind of media, if you rely on that kind of media, log on to KALW and support KALW. $100 will send you the book. Maybe you can afford more. We've had a few people give a dollar a day, $500 gifts, $1,000 gifts. If you can do more, you can make a huge difference for KALW. As John said, it's easy to be critical. I know it's very easy to be critical, but there are so many journalists out there doing incredible work, and we spend a lot of time looking for new journalists, young journalists, maybe young female journalists who might not be asked to come on the cable shows, but they do such incredible work. We bring them on. They've never been on the radio before, and it's a really great place to bring on these new voices. So support that kind of independent radio, KALW.org. If you can afford $25, that's great. $100 will send you a copy of John's new book, Uprising. Maybe you can afford more. The point is, it's a collective effort. With your support, we can stay strong and we can take risks and continue doing these really important shows. This 2012 election is expected to cost $6 billion. Can you imagine what we could do with just a percentage of that money on KALW? $6 billion. And we are going to follow this very closely, follow the money, find out who's getting it, find out who's putting these ads on the air. That's the kind of media that we need in this crucial time. KALW.org. That money will not go to ads. It's going to content, to the content that you rely on a daily basis. And so many of you rely on the Friday Media Roundtable. I get emails from people actually across the country. A lot of people in New York write and say, I look forward to the Friday show. Please make sure you put it online. So support that kind of radio, KALW.org. We're totally independent. That's what keeps us strong and really gives us the flexibility to really ask these questions and bring on this information that you're not hearing in other outlets. KALW.org. KALW.org. Thanks for supporting independent radio.
This is KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
And welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say, when breastfeeding isn't just for babies.
What's the point of breastfeeding at 3 years old? They can eat regular food at this point. It's unnecessary. Why is this on the front of a magazine?
cover of Time magazine has caused a huge debate. It's a mother breastfeeding her three-year-old son. You can see the photo at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. We'd like to know what your reaction is to the photo and what do you think of breastfeeding children past their toddler years? Now, some of you think the photo is just setting up another battle in the mommy wars, pitting women against one another. And then there's the issue of so-called attachment parenting. What do you think about raising kids, letting baby lead the way? Do you share your bed with your children? The hashtags are Mom Enough, Breastfeeding, and WHYS.